Welcome back to the second half of The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. The energy debate in this country can be boiled down into two basic arguments: drill, baby, drill versus holy cow, my water's on fire. And certainly it's more complicated than that. And here in South Texas, we have a ringside seat to the energy revolution. Drive south on I-35 and you can see all the oil and natural gas boom with the Eagle Ford Shale made possible through fracking. But we've also got access to some of the world's best setups for solar and wind energy right here in San Antonio. And so like that kid in that taco shell commercial, why can't we have both? In the book Power Surge, The Energy Opportunity and the Battle for America's Future, Michael Levy asks that question, and he's looking for the middle ground in this polarized and inflated argument about America's energy future. Michael, welcome to The Source.
Great to be on with you.
All right. Listeners, if you want to join the conversation, give us a call, 614-8980, 614-8980. If you think that we need to rely on one part of the energy equation more heavily than the other, or if you're really convinced that there's no way that fracking could be safe, give us a call. So, Michael, let me ask you about energy independence. It's something that people talk about a lot. It's something that America needs to achieve, energy independence. And we say that actually North American energy independence using Mexico and Canada. Is that possible? Is that something we should shoot for?
We're getting a lot of benefits from rising oil and gas production. We're seeing job creation. We're seeing increased wealth on the natural gas side. We have declining emissions as gas pushes out coal. But one of the things that this will not deliver is energy independence. We've been trying for 4 years ago to produce all the oil we consume. But in the meantime, because we've depended on the rest of the world, we've taken big steps to transform the global market, to make it more integrated, more flexible, so that when events happen on one side of the world, it affects the price of oil everywhere. And even as we start to produce more oil, that won't change. So if things go haywire in the Middle East, the price of oil will spike here, consumers will have to pay more, and that will hurt the economy. And as a result, we won't be as independent as we would hope to be from these developments.
So the price of a West Texas intermediate crude would be impacted by if a war breaks out in the Middle East?
Absolutely. When war broke out in Libya 2 years ago, the price of oil produced and sold in the United States increased just as much as the price of oil produced in the Middle East did. Now, as we move forward, people might ask, well, if we're producing all the oil we consume, wouldn't we be separated from global markets? And the bottom line is that the last barrel of oil is what sets the price. And if our oil is far lower priced than others, they'll bid it away, they'll pay that higher price, and we'll still come back up to that world level. So one of the things that emphasizes is that even as we benefit from increased oil and gas production, we still need to cut the amount of oil we use so that when the price goes up quickly, we aren't hit so hard economically.
But when people talk about energy independence, aren't they really, you know, it's an echo of the OPEC embargo, that we, America, would not be vulnerable to another cutoff of foreign oil imports?
That's right. But in the 40 years since the first OPEC oil embargo, the global energy system has transformed to make us a lot more resilient. If OPEC countries tried to embargo us today, we would go out onto the market and buy oil. We would take oil from our strategic petroleum reserves and use that to tide us over. We have a whole set of tools that we've put in place to help deal with the embargo problem. Today we have other energy problems. We're exposed to volatile prices. We have environmental challenges. We need to be creating jobs in this country, and energy is an opportunity for that. But one of the things that one of the problems that we no longer have is this embargo threat. One of the arguments I make throughout the book is that we're still trying to solve some of the problems of the 1970s, and we're still having the same fights as we did in the 1970s, even though the world has changed drastically since then. And in order to fully take advantage of what's happening now and to really understand what it means, we have to ask, what does it mean in today's world, not just what does it do to the problems that we had 30 and 40 years ago?
Now, a lot of people think our energy future is in renewables, particularly wind and solar. Not so crazy about nuclear.
I think we need a broad set of zero carbon options so that we have as many opportunities as possible to confront the challenge of climate change. Renewables are one area of opportunity, and we've seen big gains in the last few years, a doubling of wind and solar generation, plummeting prices, particularly for solar. Nuclear, at the same time, has been stagnant, but it is the one zero-carbon source of electricity that's established at a very large scale. Entire countries generating most of their power from nuclear. And the third category that we still need to be pursuing are tools that let us capture the emissions from coal and gas-fired power plants and bury them underground, potentially to enhance oil recovery. To me, the world of energy and our thinking about energy needs to be focused on making us more resilient, giving us options. And so pursuing each of these pieces makes a lot of sense.
When we talk about energy, you know, there's different being able to power my car to make it go and also being able to turn on my lights in my house or power my air conditioning.
That's right. And that's another extraordinarily important distinction. In the 1970s, when we had our last serious national conversation about energy, we actually used a lot of oil to produce electricity, to turn on the lights in your home. That's when people started talking about using nuclear power to become more energy independent, because you could use it to replace oil and power. Over the last several decades, we've been very good at getting oil out of power generation. And so now it's in the transportation world. So we need to focus on solutions that work for the electricity world and solutions that work for our transportation so that we can break the monopoly that oil has on our cars and trucks so that we can be more flexible in the face of volatile prices and crazy things that happen on the other side of the world that affect us at home here.
All right, I'm going to go to the phones real quick. Tom wants to join the conversation. Tom, welcome to The Source.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just have a quick question, and then I'll hang up to hear. So for those of us who think wind and solar is at best a local addition to the solution, how might you explain to us how it might work on a national scale? Thanks for taking my call.
All right, thanks, Tom. Go ahead, Michael.
Thanks, Tom. It's a good question. Look, firstly, any source that ultimately works on the national scale has to be built up from pursuing it at different local areas. And I think it's important that we're driving it forward in a variety of places, including Texas. Texas would be the sixth largest wind producer in the world if it were its own country. I'm not someone who argues that wind and solar are ready to be deployed across the country as the dominant source of electricity yet. It's still much cheaper to generate electricity from natural gas in particular, and in doing that, we can still reduce our emissions. So in the short run, I think the core focus is going to have to be on using gas to transform our electricity system. But as we pursue wind and solar and other renewable sources at these local levels, we'll gain experience, we'll bring costs down, and then they have the opportunity to emerge as a more competitive source of electricity.
All right. Michael, so, I mean, really quickly, I mean, what is the percentage we're getting from our renewables right now in the country?
It's about, if you don't include hydroelectric power, which is by far the largest source of renewables, if you just focus on wind and solar and geothermal, which are what people are typically talking about, it's a percentage point or two of U.S. generation. It's a very small part still.
All right. Well, we're going to continue the conversation. We'll have to take this break. The number to call to join the conversation, 614-8980. We're talking to Michael Levy about the book, The Power Surge, The Future of America's Energy Needs. Stay tuned. This is The Source on KSTX. We're talking about America's energy future with Mike Levy. He's the author of the book, The Power Surge. So, Michael, you know, past predictions about America's energy future, they've always been so bad and off the mark. Why is that, and why is yours different?
They have been bad and off the mark. If you go back 5 years ago, we were off on pretty much everything, oil, gas, renewable energy, cars. What I try to do is stay away from too much in the way of prediction. I lay out the different courses we could take and the factors that are going to influence them from environmental to economic to technological. But then I argue that one of the big lessons of what's happened the last 5 years is that we need to be resilient. We need to develop options and we need to develop strategies that allow us to absorb these big surprises, take advantage of these big surprises. So that means broad-based rules that penalize things that are dangerous, excessive emissions, too much oil consumption, efforts to boost technology so that we have a host of different options. It's resilience and risk management rather than trying to make the world perfect based on some fantasy that we know how everything will turn out. That's the way to really make progress on energy.
We have an energy conversation going on in the U.S. It's a very practical issue, but it becomes ideological often. People, they demonize the technologies like fracking or other parts of the political spectrum, think that there's no room for wind or solar, that it's not serious.
We do have an intensely polarized discussion. If you go back to the last time, it was this polarized. It was really the 1980 election. And people, instead of talking about energy in its own right, were talking about energy symbolically. They took positions on energy to tell people how they felt about the role of government in society, or about the best way to create jobs, or about how they thought about how the role of experts in policymaking. And what you found was when people use energy to send messages rather than to actually deliver on big goals the country cared about, we came to a standstill. And so you went from the mid-70s where oil production was recovering because of the unlocking of Alaska, and consumption was falling because of deregulation and new fuel economy standards, to the late 80s, where you had falling oil production, looming restrictions on access to new land, and at the same time as this setback happened for oil and gas, you had starving of clean energy for funds and a halt to new fuel economy rules to push us into more efficient cars and trucks. So everyone lost. Instead of people winning, or at least one side triumphing, everyone lost. And that's what we're starting to see again in recent years. If you go back to 2008, you had two presidential candidates fighting on pretty practical grounds over whose plan for oil production was better, whose cap-and-trade system was better. Today you have, instead of the Keystone fight, or you have wars over fracking, or people trying to demonize either oil production or clean energy. If we slide further in that direction, what I worry is that it's not one side or the other that will prevail, but that both sides will get knocked down in the process.
Okay, back to the phones. Jack wants to join the conversation. Jack, welcome to The Source.
Thanks.
Go ahead, sir.
Tell me a little bit. I've been involved. I live down the street from a really progressive school, Alma Heights, that takes advantage of storing energy that they can in the form of HVAC thermal storage. Be curious to know what his input would be on, you know, does the wind blow hardest in West Texas at night or during the day, and is it hard to get electricity off the grid at night? What if we had a way to capture and harness some of that so that we could use it the next day? Number one, because it's cheaper. That's the biggest driver. That's why most people care. And number two, because it is green and we can burn less fossil fuels. Is there a push there? Have you seen any thermal storage techniques be successful?
All right, Jack, thanks for that question. It's a really good one. So, Michael?
It's a fantastic question. West Texas does have a lot of wind at night. I tell a story in the book about a record-setting heat day in Midland, Texas, where there was so much wind blowing that power prices actually went negative. Generators had to pay people to take power from them. That's a sign that something is amiss. One of the holy grails for energy technology for a long time has been storage. And in particular, people have focused on batteries, whether that's to store electricity that's produced when you don't need it so you can use it when you do, or for cars so that we can electrify more of our vehicle fleet. But some of the most exciting innovation in storage is related to what your caller is talking about. Instead of storing things as in batteries, you can store them in the form that they're needed. So one thing you've seen is Walmart stores in a lot of places using wind power and storing the energy that's created, not in batteries, but in freezers, storing it as cold so that they can then essentially, and I'm simplifying here, but open the freezers and use that to cool the store during the day. So having solutions that match the way we apply things in practice can really make big gains. That's one of the reasons that we need to make sure we're getting these technologies out in the field. People talk about needing a lot more R&D in the labs, and that's important. They're big science technology breakthroughs that we can find. But a lot of the time, what you need is to put these technologies out in the field and people find new ways of using them that really match the needs that are out there that they would have never discovered just sitting around a conference table.
But necessity drives invention. Necessity would be cost. You know, people are looking for ways to save money, so you have to have a higher cost to trigger them to make them do that.
Cost is a part of the equation, and we need to make sure that every energy technology pays the full cost associated with it. If you have a technology that delivers power for really cheap, but that emits so much pollution that it causes health problems broadly, that has to be folded in. So that's one piece of it, is getting the cost right. But it's also essential, as we get these technologies out there, to bring the cost down. Cost is not static. 10 years ago, people would have said that producing natural gas domestically rather than importing it would be the high-cost option rather than the attractive low-cost one. Technological change has turned that completely on its head in the last decade.
But introduction of a carbon tax is something that could be a part of that equation.
Absolutely. I think there are a variety of ways to make the way we use energy pay the full price associated with them. A carbon tax is one option, not particularly politically viable right now. Cap and trade was one that people have soured on. You could see a clean energy standard that, again, makes more polluting technologies pay the price for the emissions they entail. There are a host of different ways to do this. The key is to focus on the result. We get a little buried in these debates over which little policy we prefer. The results are what are essential, whether it's through a carbon tax or some other tool that achieves a similar result.
Okay, let's go back to the phones. Tom wants to join us. Tom, welcome to The Source.
Hello. What happened to the excitement about fuel cell technology? And also they were going to have energy production from algae, from sewer water, and things of that sort. You don't hear about that anymore.
All right, Tom. Good questions. Michael?
Fuel cells were really hot about a decade ago. They're something that engineers love because they're extremely efficient. But they face a basic problem, which is that you need to pursue an entirely new infrastructure for fueling at the same time as you pursue a new generation of vehicles. And so you have the classic chicken and egg problem. Algae is something where people are pushing forward on technology, but scaling from the lab to an industrial scale is extremely challenging. When I look at these vehicle technologies, that's one of the reasons that I'm more optimistic about electric vehicles. Because we have an evolutionary pathway that we can see from the hybrid electric cars we've got today to plug-in hybrids where you can charge up but still use a gasoline tank, and ultimately to fully electric vehicles, because you can move progressively, because so many people already have a way to charge in their homes at night, so you don't fall into that chicken and egg trap that we have with fuel cells in particular. But I wouldn't write them off. When I was writing the book, I went out to Ford's research facilities outside of Detroit. And when you talk to engineers there, they'll still tell you that in 20 years, they think fuel cells are an important piece of the equation. I wouldn't write them out yet, but I wouldn't be expecting to drive a fuel cell car in the next 5 or 10 years.
Now, when we talk about the energy debate, so many hot points involved in this: jobs, wealth creation, overall economic growth, national security, our foreign policy, climate change, environment, quality of life issues. There's so many different factions, and they're all vying to try and to control where we go in the future with our energy.
It's interesting because when you talk to people who are most animated and most involved on a day-to-day basis, they have one of those issues that they're typically obsessed with. It's either climate change that should drive all our decisions, or the economy that should be the most important thing, or national security that should dominate. The reality is that most people care about all of these things, and we need strategies and a path that is able to deliver on all of the fronts. That's why I argue for what I call a most-of-the-above way of doing things. Not the entire kitchen sink, because too much coal consumption is dangerous for climate change and excessive oil use is dangerous from a national security and economic perspective. and because pushing too hard on alternative sources would be excessively expensive, but one that does use all of these tools in order to have payoffs across the board. I also think politically, you're not going to get there if it's a path that only works for one small part of the population.
But it won't,
you need an approach that has something for most people.
Really, really quickly, the counter whenever the government gets involved in trying to guide an energy future is like we're picking winners and losers. Real quickly, response.
That's part of why, to come back to your point on a carbon price, you need to set the basic direction and then let the market sort out most of the details, rather than picking particular technologies that will win or lose. But we do need to take into account the dangers of various sources and the opportunities with various pieces. I don't think that a blind strategy that does nothing to differentiate between good and bad sources of energy.
All right,
Michael
Levy, thank you so much for joining us, the author of The Power Surge, Energy Opportunity and a Battle for America's Future. This is The Source on KSTX. Thanks for listening.
The Source is a production of Texas Public Radio. Paul Flav produces the show. Oversight is provided by TPR Program Director Wayne Coble. Chris Udaly is the TPR web editor, and production assistance comes from Catherine Dixon. Support for The Source comes from the contributors to the Community Engagement Fund, including the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.